I put on the board, why did the West succeed while the rest of the world languished, suffers? I'm a little bit torn about teaching this stuff, but some months ago, maybe longer than that, I got to thinking, where in our culture, Christian culture, where do we get any information about economics and how God runs the world? Where do we get that information? Where is it taught? But what you're going to get this morning is never taught in church, and it's not taught in schools, and it's not in, you know. And so this is where I came to it a few years ago, maybe a year ago. I said, you know, the stuff that we need to know about how God, we have one of the, I could go on forever here, and I've got to get to my lesson, but one of the groups, some of you know the Collingworth family. And he said, if I ever get, and they're probably the best group, and if we could ever get them, that would be wonderful. But anyway, he said, if I could ever sing before Congress, if they'd ever invite us to sing, I have the song that I'd sing to them. And we all sat and wondered, well, what did he sing, you know? And then they sang it. If this is my Father's world, how does it go? I was going to bring the text. And let no one forget, though right and wrong, though right seems wrong, but never, it is my Father's, you know, will yet. Yeah, in other words, it's not Congress who runs the country or the world. It's God, right? So that was why that would be the appropriate song. This is my Father's world. So I'm coming to you with that premise. There's no subject that I think is off limits when we're talking about my Father's world. Because if we can't talk about it in the church, where are we going to talk about it? The public school is not going to bring it up. I'm sorry to say, all the other Christian schools, not our Christian, but you know, generally, this is considered kind of off-limit and considered political. And since it's political, we can't touch it. And we have groups or generations of kids come up and have no idea about how things work. And so when socialism shows up, as it is right now again, many of the young people chase after it as they think that's the solution. So where would they ever be told it's not right? So anyway, and I wonder even about our own selves, could we explain certain things? Are we aware of it? So that's why we're doing this. And by the way, what I'm doing is a light introduction to the subject. I would like someday to do this. I might do it on Wednesday night, a longer involved section. And it explains things. You know, I've always said to you, the history explains things. That's why we learn history. And I had another phrase I was going to bring. My feeling this morning didn't let me do anything useful. I was going to bring another phrase about how important history is and what it does to us. So that's kind of what I want to do with you again this morning. And it's history that we probably don't think about because it seems political. And it isn't political. It's how God put the world together. Then it's not political. Then it's theological. Now, does politics mess with it? Of course. All right, so we have this five-lesson interlude we did, which came out of our European study, a trip. So we're at the end of our summer. Really, we are now, Labor Day. We left our study, Bible as Contact, which we'll pick up, trustingly, next week. We left the Bible as Contact for a few weeks and have looked at some special questions that I hope have been of interest to you. The question, why did the West succeed? And the rest did not. And you might not think that, well, they did. No, they didn't. You name a third world country where you would rather live. Arguments complete. So we are answering that it succeeded because of Christianity. While the scope of this inquiry is huge, that's why I say every time I have a panel for you here, I'm thinking it could go into lots of stuff here to explain this. So I'm going to just skip a lot and go to assume a lot. And you may have some questions that are raised because of what I've said, but there are answers that I'm not going to have time to answer to deal with. So we're going to hit the high points. While the scope of this inquiry is huge, we are only introducing some ideas or observations, perhaps, for later study. So, first, in trying to be clear about Christianity, this is a review for you. What is Christianity? The question always comes up, what is Christian? How can we talk about Christianity unless we include the saving gospel? Some conclude that if the saving gospel is not in the meaning of Christianity, then it is not Christianity. That's kind of the problem we have here. Therefore, something is said to be Christian, but excludes the gospel. It is an apostate something, but not Christianity. Yet we still talk about it as Christianity. A distorted Christianity, surely. No real Christianity at all, they would say. But as I've said, this is not quite completely correct. This is my little diagram. We have Christianity and we have saving Christianity. The green on the top is the full-blown scope of all teaching of the Bible. We know it as the Judeo-Christian understanding of truth. In that, we can subdivide that down to the truth that does not save, which would be like things in science, the things that are empirical that you can examine and repeat and, you know, can prove by repetition that that's true. And then we have the saving faith or saving truth. All right, so in the middle of the truth about origins, functions, and purpose, this is uniquely Christian truth. And that's where we probably miss it. We don't realize what is uniquely Christian about our understanding of origins. It comes from the Bible. It comes from God. Everything else that's wrong about this, which is evolution, all the offshoots of that, do not come from God. So these uniquely Christian truths, so you can have a person that believes in creation is not saved. And there are a lot of people that believe in creation are not saved. All right, so just keep that. So we're going to have a broad definition and a narrow definition, and we're going to talk about the broad definition most of the time because we understand saving faith, saving Christianity. But when we talk about Christianity, it can be more than just the saving aspect of it, because I know it is because that's how you talk. And we all talk that way. I just want to make sure that you're comfortable with it. So to be sure, there are two sources of truth. They must not be mixed in our thinking. Revealed truth, that's one, information that comes to us directly from the divine. The written word is our usual meaning. In history, you have the prophets, the apostles, and so forth. But for simplicity, we just call it the real revealed word of God. And then we have discovered truth, empirically discovered realities. Thinking that you can, you know, that's what's good about God's science. It's reputable, demonstrable, verifiable. You can do the same experiment a million times, always come with the same result. And that's how important that is. But see, that's because God put it together. So empirically discovered realities, these are things that you, empirically means you test these things. These are discoveries that 2 is half of 4, no one can argue with that, some would like. That water is 2 parts hydrogen, 1 part oxygen, can't argue with that. And true things that happen in history, which can be distorted, but there are true things that happen in history. I was born August 20, 1937. No matter who wants to lie about it, that will never change. And my mother was there, by the way. She could verify it. So last time we talked about the church. Now, so there's going to be a connection here. Last time we talked about the church, that the church changes, has changed over the centuries. That this is a particular difficult subject to generalize about, the church. We said that the Roman church today is not the church of the early centuries, nor is it the church of the Reformation time. And then we read about the Pilgrim Church, a group of people who often were not even gathered in a recognized body at all, but lived in, near, or even outside the established church. They were just called the Pilgrim Church because what else are you going to call them? But they were going to the Catholic Mass once a year because it was obligatory. And there might be some that refuse that. So when is it Christian and when is it the church? Well, some answer it this way. If it is Christian, if you're born again, that's where we started. When is it the church? It's only the church when the people in it are born again. Otherwise, it's not the church. But wait a minute, we got some problems here. The answer is somewhat confusing. We're mixing institutions with persons. The church is an institution, and members of the church are individuals. They're not institutions. So therefore, we want to answer probably a little better this way. It is Christian when the roots and sorts of it are in and of God. If you can trace the knowledge of truth of it, the teaching of it back to God, then it's Christian. I don't know what else you'd call it. I mean, in our day, it's Christian. In the Old Testament, I don't know what word you'd use in the Old Testament. So our broad definition from our chart, it is the church when the roots of it are in and of God. So I have a broad definition of Christianity. I have a broad definition of the church. Bothers us a little bit because we think of the church as only believers. It's okay to think that way, but. So how has the church changed? So we have the same problem with the question as we have with the question about what is Christianity. We can ask, what is the church? We're going to have to answer, what is the church? In the same way, we answered, what is Christianity? There is a saving Christianity, and there is a cultural Christianity. There is a saved church, then there is a cultural church without salvation. So I'm saying, you see the difference there. Now, we can differentiate between truth that does not save, truth that does not save, and truth that does save. We can make a distinction there. This distinction is known in the heart and ultimately known only to God. I mean, I'm looking at you, and as far as I know, by your profession and your interest and interest in the scriptures, that you are saved. But I cannot see in your heart what God sees, and maybe someone's not saved. I'm not putting anybody on the spot, but this is true. It's the way it is. I can't see your heart. God does. So when I say you were all saved, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, of any other group, we can't say that, especially in the morning service when Gil preaches. So the distinction is known in the heart, ultimately only known to God, this distinction. He's really part of the church, he's not. Although we have been given good clues, I have a good idea, you're belying yourself a little bit because you're here, didn't go to the ball game, which doesn't exist anyway. But that would be a proof that you're really Christian if you came here and not go to the ball game. Sorry, Leona. But you get the point. So however, the church organization is a public institution and is visible. We can count the members on the roll of the church. But since true membership is a hard thing, here we go again, it is likely that we are not able to sort out the true members from those who are simply adhere to the church that are unsaved members in the church, but they're called members. So the public church will be a mixed church. I don't like that, but it is. I'm sorry, it's going to have to be. No matter how I don't want it to be a mixed church, and I teach that the true church is not mixed, and the intention is that we don't have a mixed church, but the fact of the matter is it is a mixed church, mixed with believers and unbelievers in it, on the rolls. A church composed of believers and unbelievers. Certainly this was anticipated by the Lord of the church. Without dealing with how the church can remain as pure as possible, which is another whole subject, we at this point agree that the church in its history has a dismal record of maintaining faithfulness. It's always been a mixed church. What does church history look like? Well, remember my list of heresies in the history of the Roman church? Now, we tend to be quick and critical of the former church for not dealing with their errors. Why did they allow all this? And they should have dealt with their errors, but remember that there continues to be an institutional church for all to see, the part of the church which has lost the truth that saves. There's an institutional church that is called the church, but it's lost the truth that saves. I think that's Roman calls. Those are those that are cut off. Yet it continues to be called the church today and is treated as a church by all. I remember I joked about the Unitarian church for a while. They lost the C on their church. Now I always call it the urch. And so at least they're being honest. But even the Unitarian church is called a church. I mean, isn't the Unitarian, I know we want to be, you know, kind of cute and say, well, it's not really a church, is what, but it is a church. Now, I'm on a limb here, but I'm not far off base here. Notice what Revelation 2 and 3 says about the church. There are several references to the seven churches. This is regardless of the faithfulness or lack of it. Interestingly, all seven entities are still called the church over which the Lord of the church judges. And you know, some of those churches got some really weird stuff going on inside. But the Lord still calls it my church. Perhaps we too ought to understand that when a church is formed by intention, that has to be there, that it will stand in judgment as a church, not as something else. So the Unitarian Church will stand in the day of judgment by God, the judge, as a church. Okay, Christianity and church, these have parallels of faithfulness. Those who had experienced saving faith, that's truth, diminished, saving faith people, diminished in proportion to all those who only adhered to Christian truth. The adherer's size grows and the real believer's shrinks. Okay, now that's concerning Christianity. Those who experienced saving faith thus were born again church members, diminished in proportion again to all church membership. Again, so the church membership grows in unbelief, whereas the proportion of unbelievers gets smaller and smaller. But still, the group is called the church. But the surprise is, now here's what we're talking about. The surprise is that those who live by Christian truth, the part that does not save, caused the West to succeed over the rest of the world who had no such underpinning. They got the benefit of Christianity, but without getting the benefit of saving faith. And again, it's mixed. It's not perfect. So these are the uniquely Christian features that I think that we want to kind of remember. Real hope in progress, that you can use your mind to experiment and make better plans for the tomorrow. Real hope for something better. Science and the possibility of knowing the Creator. You know, it's not an accident. There is a design behind it all. Before I had that picture of the lion up there, and I looked at that lion. It's not my picture, but I looked at the lion, and I said, look at those. They've got little hairs, what's the word, around the eyes. And then next to it, the hairs are a little longer. And then over by his nose, those hairs are different. Then he got whiskers that go out like this. How do those hair follicles know what to do? And we're not talking about 25. We're talking about thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of hair follicles that each one of them is programmed. Program means somebody has to tell it what to do. It doesn't happen without being told what to do. So we have science now. We have the possibility of knowing the Creator. And I look at that, and I said, that code that's in each one of those cells, the DNA code, all the cells have the same code, by the way, and how each cell breaks off and does its own thing, I don't know. But that all goes back to a Creator who has knowledge and wrote the program for it and programmed it to do these various things. But how long would it take for luck to generate one hair follicle? Well, then we have the third thing, personal freedom to act on to innovate. All right, and then we have capitalism to create wealth by benefiting all. All right, those are the four things: hope, science, freedom, capitalism. Now, two subjects to address. And that question is, why only in the West was there success? First, the rise of individual freedom, the rise of the individual. By the way, I'm going to start this next Wednesday. When do we start Wednesday night? It's going to be this part. The rise of the individual in the 19th century. The rise of the individual came about in the 18th century as a result of Christianity. And I'll explain that teaser. Okay, the rise of individual is Christian as well. The rise of the individual. What's the opposite of the individual? Tell me. The opposite of individual is the group, right? You do everything for the group. And all of a sudden, do a thing for the individual. Whoa, that's different. So the rise of capitalism, which I'll define later, as the basic engine that develops economics, is a God-authored system. It's not an option that man, well, let's do it this way, or let's do it this way. This is a competing. No, this is God's authored system. That's why we need to teach it in our churches, somewhere, someplace. Our kids need to be told. I don't know where this is all get done. But does God care about economics, somebody is going to say? And the answer is, ought to be yes, because that's how we function. Remember, this is my Father's world. And let us not forget, this is my Father's world. This is not the devil's world. Don't go Greek on me here. This is not the devil's world. This is the Father's world. The devil's got a time when he's on a short lease, but this is my Father's world. And he has authored the system how we should function socially. We are social beings. We interact with each other. But does God care about economics? Where is it taught? That's where I started. Where is this stuff taught? Are economic ideas political inventions and off-limits to Christians? I hope not, because if it is, we have no place to teach it, because it's not going to come to you normally. And it isn't developed as a theology in the Bible, but it's taught indirectly in the Bible. I'll show you that. So God made the world and the men that are in it and how they should function together. They're social beings that they interact as they fill and subdue the earth to grow the population and to produce something. Matthew 25, in the judgment section here, man on a journey trusts his wealth to a servant. Some are faithful, gaining more wealth. Others are slothful, simply maintaining wealth. The example the Lord uses of faithfulness often involves the handling of wealth and the making more of it. This needs no impulse of greed or theft, that is, stealing from somebody. Because that wouldn't be making it anyway, right? You're changing pockets. That is, make this, and I say make this a study. I challenge you, make it a study. It's always capitalism. And well, I'll define for you in a minute. There is nothing but the encouragement to acquire private property and add to it honorably. Now, that is almost in the face of everything you hear out there today. It's so mean-spirited, take it from somebody else, which is not what we're doing, which I'll explain in a minute. But that's how they pose it. Now, the Bible talks about it this way. And the one who had received 5 talents came up and brought 5 talents, more talents. 5 more talents. Double his money. Master, you trusted me 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. And the master said to him, well, done good and faithful servant. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. In other words, the ones that succeed are given more, not less. Always that's the problem. That's the picture. Now, how does biblical economics work? We all have money, more or less. How does it happen that you have any at all? That's the big question. How do you have any money at all? I come look at your bank account. How did it get there? So the foundation of truth, and we even talk like this, the foundation of truth that money must be made. M-A-D-E, made. We use the very expression, we've got to go out and make some money. We talk about who it has what and how did he get it? Did he inherit it? Did he work for it? Did he find it in the street? Did he win a lottery? There's no way around the idea that money must be made in order for wealth to exist. We're talking about stuff that people out there that are opposed to what God's doing do not want to hear. Now, printing money may seem good, but printer money makes no wealth, does it? Stealing money transfers wealth, but does not make new money. It just changes the pocket it resides in. So Economics 101, which I had at K-State, and I loved economics when I was at K-State. Mitchell Scott was our teacher, and I do not know whether he ever explained capitalism for me. If he did, it would, like it would probably everybody else in freshman class. And now, Economics 101, in order for a nation, business or individual, to survive, individual, nation, or person, family, whatever, he must contribute to the pool of wealth. If more is taken from the pool than is put in, disaster looms. It's not bad that some have less, others more. That's not what's so bad. What is bad, and it's horrible, when no one creates wealth and no one has anything. That's the real bad thing. And that's where you end up. All right. So making wealth. We all want to do this. Now, how is wealth made today? It's probably not taught in any school, primary, secondary, college, unless it has a biblical foundation, then I wonder even here. But wealth is created by making something. Now, this is not hard, but think about it. By making something or providing a service in conjunction with the thing you made that has value. Here it is. Value to somebody else. The value that exceeds the cost of making it. That differential is created wealth. Now, if I make something no one wants and I don't sell it, there's no wealth created. Now, if I make something and I sell for less than it costs me to make, the pool goes down, the wealth in the pool goes down. So I got to make something and then sell for it more than it costs me. Okay, that's where the wealth is made. All right, that's created wealth. So I use my walking stick. Remember this. I have used my walking stick as an example of creating wealth. If I buy the materials for a walking stick, fix it with conveniences like a leather strap, a rubber boot, a rubber foot, or even decorate it to make it look nice. Remember, these little artsy things on there besides the practical are all there. If I can make each walking stick paying labor, even transportation costs to the mountain path where I'm going to sell it, and it would cost me $6 per stick to make and get it there and sell it to a weary and very, very grateful walker for $10, the $4 profit, is wealth created. Very simple concept. Very simple concept. And if God's going to tell us how things work, we have to have it simple. Now, by the way, what is the gross national product of the United States? That's exactly what you measure. In the aggregate, this is the gross national product for any nation. What it costs to make something and what the cost... The value, not the cost, but the price of it that it was sold. Not that you offered it. It had to be sold. Not that you offered it as it was sold, because that establishes the value. While some find precise definition of capitalism difficult, and most do, and they get into paragraphs, I want to keep it simple. We will stick with my basic idea, leaving questions of regulation, greed, and sin nature, and distortion of creating wealth aside. There are all kinds of places where this could go awry, but the idea is still the same. Capitalism is creating wealth, period. And why do we call it capitalism? Capital is wealth. All right, it's not a bad word. Now, for capitalism to succeed, there must be personal freedom, You can't do this in a jail. To innovate, be able to predict and experiment. And when you're done, you have something that's better. You made progress. These people on the walking path need sticks, so I've given them a stick. They were glad to pay $10 for it. I'm glad to make $4 on it. So that's the process. You know, we don't do these things. In the end, we have horsepower replaces manpower. Captured water falls, or steam power, or the internal combustion engine. These engines replace horsepower. Also remember that we live in a dangerous world where all developments are not perfectly safe. I just watched a movie last night about a dam breaking in Johnstown, Pennsylvania in 1898. Wow, what devastation. Well, why did they have a dam? I don't know that particular case, but you build a dam so you have water that goes over the wheel rather than water undershoots the wheel underneath, which is a lot less powerful. You throw the water on top of the wheel, you have a lot more power. Innovation, you got to build a dam. You build a dam, you got a dangerous thing because it broke. I mean, I know those things, so that doesn't change the system. We live in a dangerous world. So personal freedom supported by the government, very important part of the government here, provides the protection for the individual to produce wealth. Despotic governments control the innovator, the wealth maker. Wicked kings fear rivals. Stalin killed his most innovative citizens because they were a threat. If you study anything about Russian communism or Stalin, it's horrible. It's understated. Because he killed the people that produced. Because they were a threat to him. In a proper government, my walking sticks are protected from being stolen. They can't walk in and take it, my overnight ticket. Because if that happens all the time, I'm not going to do it anymore. So notice how sensitive this is. Just the possibility of someone stealing my sticks will limit the production and its wealth. Just the possibility someone might grab my sticks and I won't be able to sell them. Well, I'm not going to do it anymore. Observe the third world economies. What guarantees of protection of property do these people have? A lot of times they have to resort to their own ingenuity. And so when you have a fence around your house, you put glass on top of the masonry fence so people don't get into your property. The government didn't do that. Each guy had to take care of his own stuff. The government should take care of that. So and capitalism succeeds, by the way, when all parties are benefited. Now, if you take capitalism in the chain of things I said, the guy that sold me the wood, the guy that made the thong for the cowhide, and the guy, gal, painted the decoration on the stick, blah, 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 and hauled it out to the mountain. Every one of those has to make something on the routine, or else it breaks down. Everybody gets something out of it. Everybody. I'm not going to haul on the mountain if I don't get anything out of it, right? That's how we think. And we don't have to think about it very long, but that's how it is. So all parties are benefited. The seller of the raw materials, the artist who decorates the stick, the merchant who sells the stick, and the end user or the buyer is very happy to pay $10 for the stick. And I ask, would you pay $50? Well, it depends on the market, you know. What if I sold it for $6? Then why would I go to the trouble of making it? I'm not going to make it for, that's not fun. In front of my risk, my own capital, do this. So everyone in the chain benefits. There are no victims in capitalism. Now, I know there are extenuating circumstances that a victim may end up being found. But in the system, it's not. No one is taken advantage of. The owner is paid for what he risked. No, the owner is paid for he has risked his money to buy these sticks to begin with. To buy the raw material, to pay the salaries, all before one stick is sold. For this risk, he is rewarded, part of capitalism. The fact is, in fact, it was profitable enough that he will be offering hats next year. Hats next year. Hopefully, selling them for a profit. The hikers are grateful for the availability of quality production on the mountain. The businessman has made a profit on the sticks, can now expand the industry to make hats, employing more people. Bookkeepers now, we have lawyers, taxes to support the government that protect this. These created jobs are all created jobs out of this one idea. He has capital for it, or if not, he can borrow it from the bank, pay interest. Everyone wins. This is capitalism, not what you're being told today. This is often overlooked reality. My walking stick came from a tree. The leather came from a cowhide. Cow ate grass from the earth. The energy that makes lifting easier comes from the earth. Water, power, fossil fuels, wind, energy, steam for burning coal, etc. All comes from the earth. This is the battleground that man is raping the earth to make life better for himself. That's what's so bad about this, they say. In the meantime, the earth is weeping so man can get his benefit. So it goes. Have you seen that? I didn't make that up. I saw that. You say, hey, that's an example. The earth is crying because of what we're doing to it. Now, why would God author an economic model where only some would win? But that is a false conclusion. In capitalism, all are lifted. It may not be equal because gains are commensurate. It may not be equal because gains are commensurate in proportion with personal risk, work provided, responsibility, talent, and all this kind of stuff. All this made more difficult in a fallen world. Don't want to forget that. We're living and doing this in a fallen world. Ever since Adam fell, he said, now you're going to have to work against the weeds, but you can still have to work and produce because the Genesis mandate didn't change. Now, we brought up the church because capitalism was developed in the Middle Ages in the monasteries. Now, you know why we talked about general Christianity and the church. That's why he brought that up. I bring those together. The monks started to develop the idea of generating wealth as we showed it. They produced more foodstuff than they needed and started to sell it for a profit. Hey, this is pretty good, George, or Francis, whatever his name was. It is possible capitalism was always practiced, I'm guessing here, from the beginning. I can't imagine it wasn't in some form. It is with the development of the West that we have records of the progress. Since it is God's order, it must have been practiced in the earliest of times. This principle cannot be ignored. So, what facilitated capitalism? It was in the West that culture went from the barter system. Have you ever bartered anything? Ever? Trade something? I have too, you know. Who got the short end of your stick? My walking stick. Well, I tell you, when I did it, I got the short end of the stick. Because the guy wanted to get rid of what he had, and he was a friend of a friend, and I couldn't say no to him. So I got a piece of photography that I had no idea what it even did. But, I mean, let's say the thing's worth twice as much as I wanted, you know. So how are you going to divide this thing in half? I mean, it's awkward and imprecise. How do you barter? You got to find something that's equal value to both of you to trade. How much of that stuff in your house works that way? It's awkward, but barter system worked for a long time, but not very well. So we had to go to a cash system, to a coin system, and some of the stuff happened in Turkey a long time ago. We had to go to a banking system. This is in Europe now, northern Italy. The international banking facilities facilitating international trade built on capitalism. And I say, all brought to you by Christianity. Now, it might be the Catholic version of it, but that's where it started. Don't want to think about Catholics today completely, but they were already off track, surely. So capitalism succeeds. Why did the success appear only in the West? Christianity provided it. The idea of hope in progress in science, the freedom to pursue their dreams, idea for better things, using capitalism to make wealth, the government protect that wealth, which is personal property, a monetary system to support widespread commerce. All that comes out of Christianity. Comes out of God's plan for the world. This is my Father's world. This is economics. Now, let's not turn Greek philosophy and say that these material considerations are beneath what God is doing. That's a Greek thought. Material things are, oh, no, don't touch that stuff. Oh, no, no, that's only you know, Satan touches that because Satan's the world's under a curse, therefore we can't touch that. That's not right. It's God's world. Let's not turn to Greek philosophy and say that these material considerations are beneath what God is doing. He is saving us, surely. Nowhere will we ever cease to praise the Lord for that. But in the meantime, he is saving us in the context of his overall plan for the coming kingdom. Don't forget that. The habitat where we are going to live our saved life. By the way, did you know you have five senses, right? What? Feel, touch, smell, pain, taste. You got five senses. How many of those are you going to take into the kingdom? You expect all of them, don't you? Yeah. All right. See, we stay in this world. Say, think about that. Oh, no, they're going to a different world. No, we're going to keep those things because that's part of who we are. Maybe we'll have another sense, too. I don't know. All right. So we have these sensibilities. Why gold streets? Why not lead streets? I mean, why doesn't God say, he's going to give you lead streets to walk on? Do I have to ask you for why? I mean, because we understand gold is precious. Why pearly gates? Because pearls are precious. He doesn't throw us a curveball and give you something, well, you should really like lead because when you understand how it really works, you'll love it. No, he tells us it's going to be gold streets because we know what gold is. I don't know what it's like to walk on gold streets. I have no idea, but I know what gold is. And if you start paving the city with gold streets, I think there's going to be an abundance of it or whatever else we need. So let us enjoy the prospect of a better life if we work hard and be totally satisfied if all our earthly plans fizzle. We're not all going to get rich. We're not all going to be poor. Some will be rich for a while and poor in the end, or poor in the beginning, rich in the end, or some of us inherit money. But there's different people do different things, part of it. Ultimately, we have this hope that God will reward us based on our faithfulness here. That's what we hope for. So the Christian West develops. This is Rodney Stark. All of these remarkable developments can be traced to unique Christian conviction that progress was a God-given obligation entailed in the gift of reason, the ability to think, that new technologies and techniques will always be forthcoming from the foundation, fundamental article of the Christian faith. When we run out of oil, we're not going to have... You know, when I was in high school, they said, we have found the last oil field. I don't know where it was. The last oil field. Oh, man, we're in trouble. The last oil field, the last one in America, I think it was. Have you been around and noticed how many oil fields they found? You know, even Israel, they're selling natural gas. You know, so if we would have believed those guys, this is my father's world negatives, all these years that we've been using these, you know, instead of riding horses, we can ride cars because gas works in cars and horses don't eat gas. And it works a lot better. We've had all these years of benefit and we still haven't run out of oil. But let's just say we run out of oil. What's the answer for this scenario? What's the answer if we run out of oil? Well, innovate and make something better. I don't know what it is, but don't think it won't happen. That comes out of the Christian thinking. So much progress took place during the so-called Dark Ages, which is the wrong word, that by no later than the 13th century, Europe had forged far ahead of Rome and Greece, talking about the ancient Rome and Greece, and ahead of the rest of the world as well. Why? Primarily because Christianity taught that progress was normal and new innovation would always be forthcoming. It should not be surprised that everything that is discoverable by our five senses are traceable to the loving, caring, benevolent, personal God who loves and cares for its creation. Remember that. He loves us and he caters to us, but in a sense he does. Pick anything, not the perverted form of it, anything that God created and we find in it joy, contentment, satisfaction, in the flower, in the food, in the family, in the joy of discovery, in the joy of knowing peace. You just keep on with the list. Whatever God has done, we find joy and contentment in it. No guilt. Equally surprising is the assault on these very things that we list as God's magnificent provisions. Where is the attack today on God's order? Against innovation. It will destroy the earth, the planet, against institutions. Give up on gender identification. We've got to redefine the family. The government and the law enforcement are off limits. We don't have personal responsibility anymore. We're just into groupthink now. And against the biblical comedy, and it's always socialism. That's the only thing that's left. If you do an individual, it's a social group. The attack on God's order, surprisingly, is on the basis of Christian principles that the little guy must be protected from those who do well. That's not right. I'm not saying there aren't protections, but the simple provision is that you don't have to... The attack on God's order, surprisingly, is on the basis of Christian principles. They say you got to protect the little guy. So it's really a Christian principle. It's a false one, which is always what they use, a false Christian principle. Well, the process starts out with the persuasion of words. When that does not work, it is impossible to stop the persuasion by the sword. You cannot stop that bridge. Note communism's bloody bath. Free markets versus command economics. Surely capitalism can be perverted by the sinful heart. But the alternative, here's just what you want to remember about capitalism. The alternative is unthinkable at any level. The alternative of socialism is unthinkable. 100 million people died as a result of Stalin in this experimentation with socialism. And it wasn't because they did it wrong, and somebody now, young people, can come like, oh, we'll do it right. Now, he did it wrong, but we'll do it right. And don't make it democratic socialism where people vote in their own guys. Well, you know how that works. We're kind of seeing that happen for our eyes. We need the kingdom, frankly. So why did the West succeed when the rest of the world struggled to maintain a survival existence? You know the answer to that question? Christianity. And I'll leave you with this. Now you have food for thought. All right. Now, we never heard this in church before, have you? Now, you might come to, Don, we shouldn't do this. I mean, come tell me that. That's fine. I just want to understand, how are we going to get this stuff taught? Where do we teach it? Do we understand it ourselves and get caught up in some of these ideas that are not working?